Would you describe yourself as heavy metal, or would you consider yourself as pop or glam rock or
street sleaze scum rock?
You said you came from mixing the new album.
Mastering.
Okay, mastering the new album.
Yeah, a little different.
All right, what is the difference between mastering and mixing and mastering? Yeah.
We're actually cutting the little grooves that play music. Press it to the vinyl.
Now the album is called Girls, Girls, Girls.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't changed.
No.
Yeah, you guys seem pretty enthusiastic about how it sounds so far.
Good. Happening. We spent almost 4.5 months recording it, which is a long time for us, and it sounds great. We really just tweaked each little instrument out and got everything sounding good.
It sounds big,
and we used gospel singers for background singers, which sounds really weird.
Is this a gospel group?
No, there's three of them, but there's the actual gospel singers and in a church, and it sounds phenomenal because it's real rich sounding, the background vocals mixed with ours, and there's like stuff in a song like Bad Boy Boogie, and with a kind of gospel thing going against the blues riff.
It's pretty wild.
It's great. I mean, it's catchy and it's interesting, and it gives it its own sound.
Well, you guys have had that certain anthemic sound to your music before, so why not a little gospel mixed in?
Yeah.
The two didn't seem to match.
We're always trying to do something different.
Well, just run down a few of the songs that you're really pleased about, in particular the one that is going to be the first one that we'll hear.
That would be Girls, the title track. Wild Side's a great song. Dancing on Glass.
All together now.
I hope you're writing these.
We got live Jailhouse Rock. From Long Beach Arena in Los Angeles last year. Yeah,
that'd be a little treat for everybody.
Yeah, it's neat. It's really good. It was hard to pick. I mean, we recorded it every night, and we had to go through all the tapes, and finally we just said, hometown, we got to do it.
There you go.
It was nice.
Let's talk about the video then for Girls. Are you thinking about it already?
Yeah, we've got some really interesting ideas.
And we're hoping it'll get played on MTV.
You're going to give our censors a hard time, is that right?
Yeah, why not?
Hello, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and for this episode, what is this, episode number 4 in the Motley Crue series, we're going to be talking about Girls, 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 and I'm joined by Baco and Loose Cannon from the Cobras and Fire podcast. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello there. Happy to be talking to you from Cobra Studio West in a parking lot of a mattress store.
Yeah,
Cobra Studio North. I'm not sure. My Midwest.
Yeah, something.
One of you's at the Cobra Studio. One of you's at the Fire Studio.
That's correct.
That's how we should do it. Yeah, I'm at the Fire Studio. Mm-hmm. I'm 4 feet from a furnace.
So anybody that is hearing and saying, "Man, they just don't have very good microphones there," just realize that no internet at the house. It is 17 degrees. I am in my car running. On my iPhone microphone because I'm committed to doing my job for rock and roll.
I'm sure that was the first thing going through every listener's mind right now.
It was. They need to know the quality of the mic, where I'm at. They need to set the scene. These are important facts, Baco.
This doesn't sound like a $50 USB mic.
That's right.
And you're going to be well compensated for your efforts, too.
Oh, good. Good. My feet are cold.
As much as he's complained, he can have my compensation. Stay warm, buddy. I'm in slippers.
Bastard.
So it's good to finally have you guys on the show. We met at the first Rockin' Pod Expo, and Loose Cannon didn't show up to the second one.
Correct. Yep, and our listenership went up a lot higher in my absence.
I just want to let you know that I'm not. I don't want to put up with any of your morning zoo bullshit on my show.
Okay, so
podcasts
no
are not supposed
right
to be funny.
Very professional.
Podcasts are not supposed to be funny.
Is Michael
so
Butler
you know.
There with you right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of name is Loose Cannon? Oh, I'm real scared of you. Yeah, so, yeah. Sorry about that guy, but
wait, whoa. Is this an intervention? We're trying to.
I'm wondering if we need. Is there some code word you want to like let us know that you're being held hostage right now? Like,
yeah.
BG, like.
Anyways, girls, girls, girls. What did it come out in? 87.
Yeah.
I looked in the Theater of Pain tour. Was less than a year long, which I was surprised by. Seemed like they would have milked that a little bit longer, but also, you know, by the time they came off that tour, Nikki Sixx was just a complete out of control junkie maniac. There's lots of ridiculous stories, but who knows what to believe with a lot of that. Nikki just spent a lot of time in his mansion with guns strung out on heroin after the tour. Tommy Lee right after the tour in May. So they came off the Theater of Pain tour in March 86. May 86 is when Tommy Lee marries Heather Locklear. And I found a nice story about their honeymoon. They went on a honeymoon to the Grand Cayman Island, and police were called when a late night fight broke out between the newlyweds at the luxurious Colonial Club. Tommy shouts obscenities while glasses smash and furniture gets overturned as the couple argues for over half an hour to the sounds of someone getting slapped, I guess from witnesses in, I don't know, adjoining rooms or the hallway. Yeah, so that was their honeymoon. Apparently, Tommy threatened to kill Heather, but then she didn't.
That sounds
press
like a typical
charges.
Father's Day for Tommy.
Maybe
that tour
fair,
was short because, you know, you got to remember Vince was on work release.
Yeah.
That's true. He had to go back in.
Probably shouldn't joke about that considering the situation. But.
No, yeah, well, we spent a lot of time talking about that on the last episode.
I imagine, yeah.
To be fair, though, BJ, when you talk about that fight, I mean, you did not add the fact that he was exhausted and cranky from driving the boat with his dick all day.
Yeah. That was the honeymoon. Yeah, you mentioned Vince. It was actually June when he served his 18 days in jail for vehicular homicide and also permanently disabling the two people in the other car. As well.
Horrible.
So 18 days in jail for that.
Yeah, it was a different time, that's for sure. But yeah, it's ridiculous. The Stanford swimmer rapist thinks that sentence was too light.
Yeah.
There's a deep one for you.
Well, then.
Deep if you're a Motley Crue fan.
It was some hard time too. With the prison guards providing him with groupies and six packs of beer and stuff like that. Those 18 days were rough as well.
Yeah.
Sure.
Oh my God. I like in the dirt too, how he complained about like, you know, not being able to have a beer on tour. You know?
Yeah.
Well, you're alive though, right? You fucking prick.
No. Yeah. But besides manslaughter and rape, what's the next part?
Girls, girls, girls.
Yes. There you go.
Well,
May 11th, 1987, by the way.
Okay. So a year after Tommy and Heather's amazing honeymoon.
A year. Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, we're talking about the behavior of these fucking guys. And, you know, in September of 86, they signed a new deal with Elektra Records. 6-album deal. So, you know, even though Vince just got away with murder and Nikki is an insane junkie, you know, bathing in vomit, and Tommy is a serial domestic abuser, you know, they get rewarded. They always get rewarded for being outrageous fuck-ups. They just are continually rewarded. You know, they put out Theater of Pain, which was basically an album they just completely pulled out of their ass with almost zero effort, it seemed like. And, you know, it sold millions of copies and... They just were, over the course of the 80s at least, they were just constantly rewarded for just ludicrously bad behavior. And, you know, I don't know, they were just a disaster.
Yeah, definitely not held accountable, that's for sure.
Yeah. You know, they signed a new 6-album deal with Elektra.
Is Doc McGee their manager at this time?
Yeah.
I mean, you, whatever you want to say about Doc McGee, greatest salesman of all time. Can you not at least agree on that? I mean, can you imagine presenting that as a product to investors?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like how much was Elektra aware of when they, well, I guess they don't have much to lose. because they just make the bands pay for everything anyways. It's like the idea of record labels investing, they don't really invest. Well, I guess they do if the records don't sell, but with a band like Motley Crue, what do they have to lose, you know? Because they know they're at least going to get their money back.
But still getting their promo departments, however that works in the back end. I just think that's an amazing situation to be in, to sign, to up your deal, is my point.
Yeah, yeah. If you're watching these guys and what they're up to.
That album was good for Elektra, though. I mean, you know, Home Sweet Home and Smoking in the Boys Room. You know, you're coming off a pretty big record, despite, you know, how you might look it back at it now. At the time, what are they? I mean, the record execs, they probably don't listen to this band on their own time period. But there was a lot of buzz, you know, sadly, because of the accident that Nick or Vince was involved in, you know. And it sounds like we're doing the Theater of Pain episode here. But, yeah, I mean, shit, coming out of that, throw a bunch of money at them. And it was Girls, Girls, Girls the first time where they started talking about how sober they were.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah,
really?
Well, you know, Nikki was like in and out of rehab.
Mm-hmm.
But
I just seem like this, the, well, we'll get into the track by track, but there are a lot of like, I'm glad I got my life figured out tracks on this album.
Yeah. He was definitely trying to clean up, you know, over the course of 86, he was a complete disaster, but yeah.
Well, I got a copy of his diary from this time.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, there's all these stories about, well, you know, he was with Vanity during this time, I think. She was his girlfriend. Yeah. And, you know, there's one story where, you know, they spent the night where Nikki's hearing voices. He actually fired his .357 Magnum through the bedroom door at these phantom voices that he was hearing. And the next morning, Vanity proposed to him. So that's another example of just being rewarded for just being a complete fuck up, you know?
Yeah, no shit.
There's a lot of stories about Nikki and his guns when he was strung out on heroin and cocaine, I guess. Neighbors would see him crawling naked through his garden with a shotgun twice a week. That's one story.
It's either Tuesday or Thursday. Nick is out there.
And he spent a lot of time in his closet with a gun and hearing voices and all this stuff. But I don't know what to believe, though. The dirt, like I always say, it's like 75% fiction, it seems like. And I never read heroin diaries, but, you know, how much of it is glorified or embellished or exaggerated?
There had to be some spelling corrected. I did read it. I actually went back to it for today.
Yeah.
Because it's written supposedly during this time. And there's some timeline things I thought were funny. But
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what, you know, Nikki was up to for until they were getting ready to make the record. And then I guess that's when he tried to clean up. And probably, again, they were due to make an album and they probably didn't have any songs. And Nikki is like, I better write some songs. So, you know, that's how...
None of the other guys felt that obligation.
No, right. They didn't.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's October of 86 when they go into the studio with Tom Werman. I don't know how long it took him to record this album. I get the feeling a lot of the songwriting was happening at the same time, which I felt the same way about the last album.
Yeah,
this isn't a band that does homework, you know.
No, I mean, like
a lot of
like
writing in the studio.
Yeah,
it's funny that they pick Tom Werman again because they trash him in retrospect all the time, like saying that they never got that sound. If you hear those interviews,
yeah, you know that's exactly.
He's
that's
three albums in a row, yeah. All successful, and you bitch about his production.
Yeah, Tom Werman was he was so terrible. They made three records with him. Exactly. Yeah, it's. Tom Werman, he gets that from several different bands and
Cheap Trick.
Yeah,
too,
and
right?
I don't get it at all. I don't see the problem with the work he did with them. And these are all bands, you know, Cheap Trick, same way. They made three records with him. So
and
if they were so unhappy with it, why would they do it two more times? I don't.
And I would say that all three had, you know, different sounds to them. I mean, they didn't sound identical as far as
it wasn't like Bo Hill with Rat.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You had kind of a nice color and shape to each one of these Motley Crue records he did.
Yeah, it's true. They definitely don't sound the same. So yeah, they record the album, however they pull that off.
BJ, I would like to share that I'm pretty sure the Girls, Girls, Girls tour is the reason my dad got divorced the second time.
Ooh.
Do tell.
This is 100% a true story. This was my first real concert, and I was going with a guy I worked with. I was like 16 years old, and, you know, this was like an older guy, and so I had dad meet him and all this stuff. You know, I'm going to a rock concert. You know, Christian Puritan parenting, wanted to make sure I was going to be safe and not get knifed in the parking lot or anything like that.
That worked out
Dad,
well.
Dad gave it his blessing. And then when my stepmom found out, they had a big fight about it. And I don't think that the fight started in a different part of the house. And I was in the basement. And I don't think she knew I was home from school. They worked their way down to the kitchen. And the fight was clearly about him giving me permission without talking to her. And he's like, you know what? Maybe Jason and I should just go find our own place to live. And then he left the room. And then I waited for a few minutes, and then I came up the stairs from the basement, and I had a very awkward eyeball exchange with my stepmom.
Oh, man.
Who was still sitting in the kitchen. No, there were other problems, but yeah, we were out of the house shortly after that.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, you got the power of Motley Crue. Do you know that, you know, between Vince has destroyed so many families. If you think about it.
Yeah.
So that guy is for a lazy guy. He's actually been pretty productive.
I've mentioned my stepmom a few times on the show. This was an upgrade for me. I was happy to leave. Like, way to go, Dad.
Yeah, well, exactly.
He's emotionally crushed. His second marriage is dissolving. You know, and I'm just like, sweet. I still get to go to Crew, right?
So you went to the Girls, Girls, Girls tour?
I did. I had some of the worst seats I've ever had to a show in my life. The inflatable motorcycle tipped over on top of the stage at the end, I remember. It was a blast. It was just my first real arena concert. You know, this is back to when the arena in Minnesota here had it was in a suburb. So there was still parking. You know, it's kind of like that heavy metal parking lot movie, almost exactly, where just cars everywhere and people, you know, getting shit faced, planning six packs, sneaking in little booze bottles. But yeah, I loved it.
And that was the tour when Tommy had the cage that spun up, that went upside down,
yep,
right?
Correct. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And do you guys know about that band Mick Mars was in that did the same thing before?
No.
Yeah. I saw some video at some point. You know, it was a much more rudimentary version. But it was a band that Mick was in. You know, Mick Mars was in a band called Motley Crue, but it was C-R-O-O. I don't know, like late 70s. And the singer.
Both times it was spelled incorrectly.
The singer of Motley Crue was a female singer named Mickey Mars.
Oh, my Lord.
This is made up.
No, it's true. Yeah, well, the guy from the band, Harry Clay, was on a podcast years ago called... Heavy Metal Harry Road Stories.
Harry.
I think it's Harry Clay. I think that's the name.
Harry Clay. Just Clay with some random hairs in it. There's like, you're just making the shit up on the fly.
Maybe right? Henry Clay.
I agree with Baco.
it's true. The podcast doesn't exist anymore. I can't find it. It was a great interview with that guy. And Mick does say that he came up with the name, or he was in a band called that. I have seen him say that too.
I think I've heard that before, but
yeah. And the singer was Mickey Mars, and I don't know if it was that. I don't know which band it was that Mick was in that also did the drum cage that went upside down. But I saw video of it too. So yeah, it's funny that you wouldn't.
Tammy Neal.
You know, Mick Mars is like the most kind of background, nondescript guy in the band, you know, and the fact that the name and different ideas came out of him, you wouldn't even think that was true. But
unsung guitar hero of that time, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's
always got great tone, some pretty inventive rhythms, you know. I mean, I think his solo for Home Sweet Home is, one of the most iconic guitar solos of probably that decade.
Yeah, that song is such an anomaly on that record. I don't know how they even pulled that off.
Tommy Lee took piano lessons.
I've got a great story from the tour.
Let's hear it.
Vince Neil was upset because on his rider, he had French's yellow mustard, but in the dressing room, he kept getting Grey Poupon. So he smashed the bottle of Grey Poupon against the wall, severed tendons, nerves, and an artery, and almost cut off one finger of his right hand, smashing the Grey Poupon against the wall, and they had to cancel the show in Baltimore.
What?
I love that.
Would he have done the same if it was Plockman's?
It's like a reversal of, you would think the person would be upset for getting the yellow mustard instead of the Grey Poupon, not the other way around.
Well, we aren't talking about a regular person. What an idiot.
Yeah.
Pardon me, would you have any Grey Poupon?
But of course.
And what, this is the tour where Mick Mars ended up marrying the backup singer, right?
Right, from, they toured with.
Yeah, she was probably, what, like a foot taller than him?
Oh, they had the same shoe size.
Yeah.
Oh, man, looks like Devin's gone silent.
Yeah, is Devin still there?
Well, it says he's there, but he's muted.
Hello? Hello?
Hey.
Hey.
Hello? Wow. Well, this explains why I've been making comments and nobody's been saying anything back to me on it.
Did you hit a mute button or something?
I don't remember hitting it, but it must have somehow
I'll
happened.
I'll keep an eye out on it then.
How long have I been gone? 5 minutes?
I don't know. At least a minute.
Because at first, okay, it was amusing because I would like throw some stuff in there right in between. And I was like, oh, I guess nobody really appreciated that. Because I'm like, what the fuck? Nobody has anything? You can't even say, like, don't interrupt me? I'm like, I'm in my own little world here, guys.
Should have gone to Mattress Firm.
Oh, you're right about that.
Probably had some commentary on the Grey Poupon.
I did. I was talking about the guitar solo with Mick Mars. I was talking about the whole Motley Crue thing. Did you hear my comment about Ball Sweat McGee?
No. No.
Jesus, I am in my own world. There's some stuff you guys would have jumped all over. I came up with all these other fake names for in Mick Mars's previous band, Motley Crue, CROO.
Damn.
I'm like, none of these are hitting. Nobody's
here. You saw we were ignoring you.
Yeah. I'm like, I thought you guys were like messaging me. Just ignore the fuck. Keep ignoring.
Ignore this morning zoo bullshit.
All right, continue on. I'm sure it'll work out.
Damn.
Glad I'm back.
Sorry.
All sweat McGee, baby. Could have been gold.
Well, okay, that was when you guys were talking about Harry Clay, which I lost my mind on.
Oh, is that Harry when Clay. You dropped out? Damn.
Yes.
Well, I bet it is, because I heard you talk about Harry Clay.
Yeah, I just think that's the greatest name.
I'm officially changing my name to Harry Clay.
It's just a bunch of just random hairs in a half-formed... all right, continue. We haven't even got to first track.
Yeah, we should probably... Let's see. I got a couple more pages of these stupid fucking notes here, but let me see.
You want
what...
maybe like how have you been doing the other ones? You've got like going into the tracks and then throw a little like personal, because there's a bunch of stuff I can riff on as far as like
where
I was.
Yeah,
like
say whatever you want.
Maybe start the tracks and like basically Wild Side, seeing that video for the first time, the tour 87. I was 13. So this is like maybe my second or third rock album ever. So I can kind of go into that too.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the other big story from this time period was, you know, Nicky's supposedly dying, you know.
Oh, yep. That's right. That happened during this period, yeah.
Yeah, and what the story of that, what he was hanging out with Robin Crosby and Slash. Is that the story? Yeah. Yeah, I guess Slash and Steven Adler were, you know, doing CPR on him.
Those are the first two people I want working on me, man.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about the worst first responders.
Imagine Steven Adler's breath as he's blowing into you. You wake up to that.
Slash.
I'll take death, please.
That guy is, you know, that guy typically, he's at least five vomits from his last toothbrushing. Plus, he's got a history of sucking some dick, in his own words. So.
Yeah, and it's a cycle. It's puke, blow for crack, and then jump out of a cake on the Eddie Trunk metal show.
There might be a pubic hair stuck in his teeth.
Slash took his top head off before he did chest compressions, and the heroin that almost killed Nikki, supposedly. I mean, this is another story that's like, all right, what's true and what's not, but that it supposedly came from Robin Crosby. Persian heroin, whatever that means. But yeah, supposedly he was dead, and I guess the defibrillator at the hospital brought him back. Is that the story?
Yeah, he was out for like a minute or something.
Yeah, but according to what this says, at least Vince Neil was told that he was dead. Yeah, Mick was told that too. Like, people were calling the other guys and telling them Nikki was dead. Because I guess he was dead at the hotel. I don't know. But that's what I found on that Chronological Cruise site. I don't know where that's from, what the source is, but yeah, Slash called Tommy and told him. Some guy named Rich Fisher called Mick Mars, and yeah, I know I saw that Vince Neil called the hospital to find out more, and they told him that Nikki just left. And he thought he was dead. So
he's gone.
Oh, and also Nikki tells a story that when he went outside, there were fans, crying fans, who had heard that he died and came to the hospital or something.
How?
Yeah, that's in the day and age before social media.
Yeah, exactly.
I never heard about this at the time.
No, yeah. You find about this 2-3 months later in Circus.
Yeah, you're exactly right. How are these fans finding this out? You know, I guess maybe like somebody works at the hospital calls somebody, or I don't know, but you know.
It took a long time just to get like, real news about Vince's car accident. And that was actually covered on the local news. I don't think this actually was. Doc McGee had probably 4 weeks to mitigate the story with like your circuses and hit paraders.
Yeah. This says the band's accountant, Chuck Shapiro, called Vince Neil to get a quote from him for the obituary. Oh, yeah. Chuck puts Vince on hold while he calls the hospital to verify, and they tell him that Nikki just left.
Yeah, this is... Nikki's a good storyteller.
Yeah,
yeah. True.
But they ended up canceling their European tour, I guess, because of this. And then Doc McGee was pissed off.
Come on, guys.
Doc calls a band meeting and tells them they will be paying back the European concert promoters out of their own pockets.
Doc McGee's had a tough life. I mean, think about it. How many times he finally is starting to calm down. He's like, now I'm going to carve some time out to go toupee shopping. And then finally, all these years later, he finally has that toupee that he's wanted because Kiss gave him that time and less chaos. Have you seen that thing? It's amazing. He took all this time to get it. Have you seen it? Have you seen this toupee? Yes or no?
Is it new?
That's all I want you to know. Yes, it's phenomenal. He has a full head of hair now.
Oh, I'll have to Google that. Yeah, I guess that's the end. That's, you know, it's like, I just wonder, as much money as these guys made, how much money did they squander or leave on the table?
All of it.
Like astronomical sums. It's fucking insane.
Yeah, I really wonder how long their farewell tour cash is going to last.
Yeah.
Especially Tommy.
Well, look, I think 2 days later, after this farewell tour ended, Vince is back at a casino, right? He's constantly, he's still touring like half the year.
Yeah. Solo. Got to get that $10,000 payday.
Well, yeah, you know, Nikki made more than the rest of them just for
songwriting,
publishing. But I bet Mick Mars is the richest one at this point because he didn't squander all his fucking money like an imbecile. Like the other
Well, he lost everything.
Oh yeah, a couple divorces.
in his first marriage for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and probably a second one. Yeah, and who knows? Hopefully, true, he took care of his money a little better on this tour because I'm rooting for the little bastard.
But you talk about, I think, you know, people say Kiss, all image, music. I think Motley is even more of, and don't get me wrong, I like the majority of Motley Crue albums, but is there any band that has more of a legend and an image more than Motley? It's more, anything you hear about, it's more about the porn stars and the I died and I came back to life and
In what, 60 songs total, maybe, in their catalog? 70? You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's so much, like, just celebrity nonsense, especially with Tommy Lee, I guess, more than any. And then, you know, Vince, a lot of infamous, embarrassing stories.
The Dirt!
Vince.
Yeah. The Dirt,
I think,
let's call
Tommy
let's
Lee's go. Dick saved Motley Crue.
Oh, easily.
They might be like Warrant or Rat right now.
Well, yeah, and the book, The Dirt. I mean, The Dirt is 500 pages. I think 17 are about the music.
Yeah, right.
If you read it.
I'm not sure we get The Dirt if it isn't for that porno.
That's true. Yeah.
I'm not sure if there's look, I don't know for sure, but that's speculation I'm happy to throw out there.
Yeah. Throw it out there. We're into it. And as prime example, we haven't even talked about one song or this album.
Yeah. In true Motley form. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Well, speaking of The Dirt and the songs,
I've also been mainlining heroin this entire time. Ooh, so by the end, it should be really good.
Injecting it into your penis, like Nikki.
Nice.
Yeah, there was one story where, there was an earthquake, and Nikki ran out of his house naked, and the only thing he grabbed on his way out was his freebase pipe. But yeah, I was going to say, speaking of The Dirt and the songs, one thing Nikki says in that book that I think is very correct is that if he hadn't written Wild Side and Girls, 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 their career would have been over. That's what he says.
Yes.
Yeah,
if those two songs hadn't been on this, if those two songs hadn't been on this album, yes.
Yeah.
It would have been a bad situation.
Yeah. So getting into the record, I guess, Girls, 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 it kicks off with Wild Side. Nikki is always real, like, he tries to be pretentious. It's kind of annoying when he tries to act like he's so deep.
Yeah, this one definitely has a serious subject matter. This would be one that's kind of a nod to, like, hey, stay away from, like, this is not a pro-drug song, at least.
Right.
You know? But he definitely talks about, you know, like, you know, the whole kind of seedy environment around a thing, you know, a little nod to Lou Reed too, you know, stealing a little bit from him there.
So at this point in young Cannon's life, you'd only had a couple, I like to talk to myself in third person, I'd only had, you know, a few albums, this being one of them, and this song I used to scrawl out like a 13 year old would. The lyrics, I think the lyrics of the song are incredible. I still do. I think this song is just filthy. It almost is like just greasy. It's, you cannot wash it off of you. This, between the guitar tone, the lyrics, and say what you will about Vince Neil, this is the why you can never have like a cover band properly do Motley Crue, because it's hard to not sing well or to be a bad singer, but you do it well. Do you know what I'm saying? As far as the sleaze and the lyrics.
Yeah.
For this, like, I like Vince Neil's vocals on this album a lot. Mm-hmm. And this song is just—it's just seedy. This is a perfect. This is my favorite. This is my favorite Motley Crue song, and always has been. From every single aspect of it, the ending where the guitar solo is at the end. I'm gonna step back a little bit, but this is between this and the video for Wild Side that sold me of what L.A. sleaze, dangerous, everything was, and it drew me into the scene completely.
Yeah, I definitely like that kind of breakdown. This song is arranged kind of uniquely, especially for the time. It doesn't just come out and hit you with that verse, you know, bridge, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus, solo. And I know, and you'll see it as you go through this, but Mick, I'm sorry, was in like a, you know, I read in a guitar magazine or something around this time, that he intentionally didn't do a lot of soloing on this. He wanted to make more songs kind of like the old school way, where it wasn't just about the flash of the guitar solo, which was very popular with the bands they're kind of stacked up against. But yeah, that whole "a baby cries, a cop dies," I mean, that whole kind of little breakdown they throw in there a couple times is kind of a cool little change, because there really isn't a straight up chorus. It's a pretty unique song. At the time, I'm going to admit, it was a bit of a grower for me. I didn't latch on to it right away, but it wasn't too long before, you know, it was, you know, one of my favorite tracks.
Yeah, I mean, just like "Papa Won't Be Home Tonight, Found Dead with His Best Friend's Wife." I don't know, there's something just dangerous about this, and it combined with the video, with the whole, you've seen the whole production, which at this time I was, you know, getting into Kiss too, where essentially, I'm going from memory, wasn't their sign essentially like a Kiss logo that just said "Crew" in the background, like a lit up?
Yeah, on the tour, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like
but
that.
But it wasn't there all the time. I think it flashed at certain points.
Anyway, "Crucifix Under My Death Wish," "Forward by Mail to Me in Hell." I love that line. It's just a quintessential Crew song.
Yeah, it's true. I was talking about how Nicky could be pretentious and, you know, like self-important and stuff like that, but he also was capable of writing cool lyrics and, you know, cool poetry when he put his mind to it. And this song is definitely an example of that. I think it's a great song, and I think it's 1,000 times better than anything on Theater of Pain except "Home Sweet Home." I mean, it's just any other
Agreed.
Song from that record, this song just makes him look ridiculous.
And the fact that this was a single is bizarre.
City Boy Blues.
City Boy Blues. I like City Boy Blues.
I like the whole record. I know what Brian's saying.
Sure, sure.
I'm not a hater of any of the first four Motley Crue.
Yeah, well, don't listen to that episode then.
but this song, songwriting, yeah. But a "Home Sweet Home" and this, if you would like line these up against the other tracks, from an arrangement and everything like that, it just absolutely crushes them.
And I love that. What is that? What is Tommy banging on? You know, for that part of this, that percussion sound. I love that. It's really great. The production is really cool on this record, I think.
It is. There is a lot of, I didn't notice until I did it back. There's a lot of, let's just call it, sound effects little bit. So that, like, this ends with the whole, you know, sirens, all kind of gunshots, and then it goes into, you know, motorcycles, which then motorcycles became part of Motley Crue, what you think of, but before that was not, right? Was there any motorcycle imagery before this time? I don't think so.
I don't think so. Yeah, so what is that sound, that percussion sound?
Where are you talking about?
He's talking about that ting, ting, ting. That kind of like...
It's only in this song.
What part of the song?
Well, we'll have in many parts of the song, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, give me one example. I think it's just... if it's what I'm thinking of, it's just hitting the ride cymbal at the very cone. And probably affected, but I'm not sure we're thinking of the same thing.
It is kind of the same...
It sounds like he's pounding on a pipe or something.
Yeah,
yes,
okay.
That's what it sounds like. Yes.
That's what it would be then, something like that.
Yeah.
Like at the very tip, the cone of a ride cymbal, you just kind of crank it right up there. And it's very percussive. It doesn't ring out. It goes ping.
Yeah, it's a cool effect.
Yeah,
it is. It's a cool part of the song.
Tommy Lee, one of my two favorite rock drummers. The guy is one of the dumbest human beings walking the face of the earth.
God.
He has anger issues, but he is an amazing drummer.
It's funny, I had, on the Shout at the Devil episode, I had Lee McCormick, who's a drummer, and he loves Tommy Lee. And then on the last episode, A.D. Adams, who's also a professional drummer, he hates Tommy Lee, thinks he sucks.
I don't think he sucks.
I can see, man.
You don't like him, but by God, I mean, I think that Tommy Lee is the... Basically, you always need to be a good drummer. You have to have a sliding scale of intelligence on one side and drumming skills on the other side. The dumber you are, the better drummer you are.
I think a lot of metalheads that I've met over the over time just pretty much fit that. Their brains are built to do this one thing really fucking good.
Yep.
And they lack everything. Then they go watch backyard homemade wrestling videos. You know, it's...
Yeah.
That doesn't really work with Neil Peart, though.
No. He's an anomaly.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Abe. Even though I think... No, it's Lee McCormick who doesn't like Neil Peart's drumming, I think.
Of course. Oh, maybe Neil cock blocked him at some concert.
Lee never gets cock blocked. He's the cock blocker.
Well, that's the only thing that could make him mad enough to hate you. You know, it's like, because that guy's always got some squish.
Yeah. So the next song is the title track, which, to me, this is a terrible album title. Why would you call your album?
Whoa, 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 whoa. First off, you know what if this album were to come out now, it'd just be called Me Too, Me Too, Me Too. Pretty sure. hashtags in between.
Pound Me Too, Pound Me Too, Pound Me Too.
That's right. Or if Lee came out with it, it'd be called Squish, Squish, Squish.
I like this song a lot. I love the riffs. The riffs that it's kind of built around are great. One thing I read is, so Nikki Sixx was writing some songs for Never Too Young to Die, which Vanity was in with Gene Simmons. And that's
okay.
When he originally started writing this song. But Gene Simmons told him it wouldn't get played on the radio. So that's some of that great wisdom from Gene Simmons.
Hey, listen, take it from somebody that hasn't had a single with my lead vocal since 1975. This won't be played on the radio.
Here's a song of mine you can try. It's called No, 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 No.
Yeah.
It's also a hit.
Basically, the story is that Nikki was going to give this song to the movie, and Gene's like, nah, that's not any good. And then Nikki kept it for the album.
Guy's an amazing businessman.
Yeah.
It's just a good pop metal song. One thing I read is that the soloing at the end of this song drops off because Mick fell off the stool. But then I listened to it and I don't hear where the soloing drops off. So it's a great story. But
no, I believe it. I believe it because if you listen to it, if you're listening to it with cans, not earbuds, kids, because you don't want to use those. If you're listening to cans, you can just audibly hear a ugh.
You hear a thump. Actually, before the solo, if you listen very carefully, you can hear him climbing up onto the stool. Little tiny elf on the shelf, Nick Mars. That
would be a great elf on the shelf special edition, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
little elf Mars guy.
Give him those away at Rockin' Pod. Don't try to steal it from us, BJ.
Oh, damn it! Reveal the merch.
He fell off the stool because his stack of yellow pages collapsed.
And right after, if you listen carefully, after you hear Mick Morris fall down, you can also hear Steven Adler's breath slowly breathing life back into him.
You know what? Garbage. That's right at the time where like Vince is like, "Hey, Tommy, look at." He's like, "What, Vince? Where?" And they're talking about.
He fell. He falls off. That's perfect. It's not about the six. It's not about Squish. It's about Mick's his vertigo problem.
Yeah.
Oh. So I have another thing with Girls, 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 if I could add, please.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're Canadian, right, BJ?
No. No, it's a Wisconsin accent.
Okay. There you go. I'm just messing around. But obviously in the Midwest, you're familiar with the fine department store, JCPenney.
Yeah, yes.
Okay. So I remember in the young, at some point, they decided it was a real cool, hip thing to do, and that was to have MTV playing in, like, the young man's section or whatever, and the first time that I heard Girls, 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 or saw the video, was at a JCPenney, and I'm watching this, I'm like, this would not happen now, where you're watching it, and you see all the strippers, and it was a glorious video, but to see it randomly at a department store, with, of course, my mom in tow, in the background, while I'm watching this, I'm like, this is phenomenal. You know, they've got switchblades. They're on motorcycles. They're in strip clubs.
Were you wearing sweatpants?
I don't know what I was wearing, but it was like in the lead. I know it was like
that's
in the
where
Levi's.
Little Lou's learned not to wear sweatpants to a strip club.
That's right. It was like the Levi's or pants at all. But it was like in the Levi's section or whatever there. But it's like you would not have that video. I mean, what a glorious time, though, to have that video out there, you know, smoking their chicks. never again would you see that at the mall, is my point.
This really is a great song, though. I mean, on so many levels. I mean, because it is catchy. It is something that non-hard rock stations will pick up and play. It was a bit of a crossover hit, and it at least maintained the level that they got with the bump from Home Sweet Home. I think this record is better than its reputation, but I wholeheartedly agree that without these first two songs, there just isn't anything else that's going to grab people like those two songs. Wild Side's going to keep your core, while Girls, Girls, Girls is not going to offend your core audience, but it's going to pull in some squish.
Yeah, and also, this is when I didn't know that the reason, you know, that is what you would see at a strip club was Girls, Girls, Girls on the sign, so I got that part. And also, what's so mainstream is that the Chipmunks had a version called Squirrel, Squirrel, Squirrels. That's not a joke. I heard that. That was on, like, a Saturday morning cartoon.
That's true?
Yes, that's actually true. Yeah, they would change the lyrics, and they would sing Squirrel, Squirrel, Squirrels in their Chipmunk voices. I'm not making this up. This is an actual fact, for once.
And that paved the way for Dave Mustaine and Megadeth to be on DuckTales.
That's correct.
So moving on to the next song, Dancing on Glass, I read that this was written in the studio because they needed more songs, but I like it. The riff is
as
cool.
As do I.
It's a cool riff. it's just saying downtown is really lame, though. that's all it could come up
downtown.
With.
Downtown.
And the idea
like the
that
song a lot too, yeah.
The idea that downtown is always this scary, dangerous place. Oh.
There's another sound effect too. That downtown, then like dong, kind of like a gong. A lot of effects.
Right. Yeah, true. But there's a very problematic line in this song. Vince Neil delivering the line, "Going way too fast, it's gonna burn and crash." Might be insensitive.
Yeah, well, I never caught that. Kind of cop to not really thinking about that whole incident. Because, you know, Music to Crash Your Car 2, Volume 1, 2, and 3.
Yes, right.
Remember
right.
That whole nonsense? They ended up not doing Part 3, I think. But this song is good. It got me looking up the word Shiva, which can mean a lot of different things. Goatee, bus, a bike. But I'm guessing they're going for the Spanish slang cocaine.
Right.
Sure.
Sweet Shiva, you were my Jesus.
Yeah.
Again, an anti-drug song.
Right.
You know?
Right.
He's like, hey, man, drugs are bad.
Yeah, where's my pipe?
Yeah, didn't one of these guys have a rock against drug commercial too?
You know, I've been playing rock and roll for a lot of years. I've done it all. Now I do it without drugs. Hey, don't get me wrong, I still party with the best of them, but now I do it clean. You know, I'm on top of everything I do.
So Dancing on Glass, though, first off, I didn't understand it was about drugs at the time. I think, like, Dancing on Glass, ooh, that would not feel good. Or think of, like, Die Hard, that scene where he has to run across glass.
Right.
Barefoot. That is seriously the images I have in my little brain at the time. But the thing that I was about the ringer I was talking about, is this really Vince Neil singing at the end, tearing it up, like soul style?
No, it's some chick or something.
Yeah, they've got...
Oh, it is? Okay. I did not know that.
I'm sure it's credited.
Yeah, they're on 5 Years Dead, too, I think, right? There's a couple of backup singers. Maybe it's one of the same.
Okay. Because it kind of, it's not that far off for what Vince's vocal sound is. I mean, obviously, they're singing their ass off at the end of this last minute. What do you think about the last minute? Silly? Good?
Love it.
Bad? I like it.
I don't have a problem with the song at any point.
Yeah, no, I like this song. Isn't glass itself a slang for cocaine? I think.
I don't know.
Or was?
Crack heroin.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Do you want me? What's do we have a lifeline with Steven Adler?
Yeah, he's busy right now. He's sucking my dick, but I'll ask him. Again.
Well, I guess move on to the next song, which.
Moving on from Steven Adler and blowjob.
All I have written down for Bad Boy Boogie is this is theater of pain level garbage, generic bullshit.
Bad Boy Boogie is not a good Motley Crue song or an AC/DC song of the same title. It's just not. What?
You don't like that he rhymed cookie jar with back of my car? This song is complete garbage. I'm done.
Yeah. Oh, man. Like, can we just move forward? It has, doesn't, and again, they throw a bunch of effects on it. Doesn't it have like horns and shit, too?
Yeah, it does. And then I love the bad is bad. And I'm like, yeah, bad is bad.
And I'll tell you, do they ever play this live from your fax?
I have no idea. They didn't play it when I saw them.
And one other thing, too. I will tell you this. Bad Boy Boogie is the 1987 version of Rattlesnake Shake. Dr. Feelgood. They're the same fucking song.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, they both suck balls.
Yeah, they're garbage and both of them have horns.
Yeah, it's basically the definition of filler, this song.
Oh, man. No, I think the definition of filler is
the
not
next
even going
song?
All the way is not Nona.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not even
Nona
a song.
Always finds its way into my playlist.
Really? Why?
Of course not, you idiot!
Oh my god, I can just imagine you just like jamming out and I was like, oh, here's a good 90 seconds of bullshit.
Madam, my head was at you.
Well,
it's about his grandmother. It's about Nikki's grandma.
Nona serves the purpose of when you look at the record, there's 5 songs on side one. It makes it look like there's 5 songs when there's only 4 songs.
That's right.
And that's pretty much all it is.
This is Motley Crue's 8.
What's worse, Nona or Brandon? You think if Nona was written while Nona was alive, Nona would have punched Tommy Lee out in his underwear? Or, sorry, Nikki Sixx.
Maybe so. I mean, yeah. I mean, you could say that Nona's better because it's shorter. But yeah, let's talk about that real quick. Girls, girls, girls. Padding, 100% padding. This is an 8-track album.
Yeah, can exactly. Talk,
can we say that?
Okay. Well, yes,
the last song.
we'll get to that.
Well,
but okay.
Yeah,
it should be 4 songs on each side, and then they attack these things on the end of each side to make it look like it's a full album. Yeah.
Kinda.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, anyway, side 2.
Side 2 kicks off with 5 Years Dead, which there was a book by Bernard Falk from 1937 that Nikki supposedly bought called 5 Years Dead. which he just took the title from. I don't think the song otherwise has anything to do with it.
Yeah, he took the premise of the book, supposedly, that, like, if you're not living your life, you're already 5 years dead or something.
Okay.
That's interesting. This song always confused me from the title. So I'm like, 5 years dead. Is this a song about somebody that's been dead for 5 years? Is this a song about the way we're living, we have only 5 years till we're dead? Or is it just a song about saying 5 years dead over and over again until the song ends?
I think this is a fairly unique song. I think it's definitely better than you're giving it credit for. I mean, again, they kind of go out of the box for song structure. And again, instead of a real solo, they just kind of stop and kick the song over again. And I thought that was kind of unique for the time. It definitely, when you stack it up against their peers at you know, what was going on, Motley Crue, at least in my, as I look back, you know, I think they seem to be more leaders during this period than they were followers. As much as, you know, Nikki and the people around that talk about how just wasted they were and it was all a blur, I think this song is an example of them actually kind of, you know, answering, you know, coming or stepping up for the challenge, if whatever you want to call it, answering the bell. I don't know.
I'd like to do a point counterpoint with Baco on this real quick. This song also, it does have that whole octave change too, like a Living on a Prayer. You know, 5 years dead, 5 years dead. And they go a little bit higher, but really, I should go back to Bad Boy Boogie. There is one good thing about Bad Boy Boogie and that is because I knew the exact spot where I could stop in that song and flip the cassette over to avoid the song to go into the next song after. That's my summary of the song.
This song was a keeper for me. I liked it even going back now. I was like, it still held up for me. I like it.
I don't like it very much, but I would say that it would be one of the best songs on Theater of Pain, in my opinion.
You really don't like Theater of Pain.
No. I think after Wild Side of Girls, 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 Nikki Six gets an F for effort.
Well.
Which is why he himself admitted that he really was lucky that he pulled those two songs out of his ass.
It's a good thing I'm here then, boys.
I like the song the first time I heard it when it was called Keep Your Hands on the Money, because that's how many times they say the chorus, 5 years dead. That song goes on forever! 3.5 minutes. As does this.
So the next song, All in the Name of, is, I wrote, it's sadly obvious and a generic impression of a song. It's just,
bad.
I just think it's really weak. Just
it
weak
was
is a good
show
description.
Opener for the entire tour, I believe.
Show opener.
Wow.
And you talk about, again, those are the times. She's only 15.
I had the same
She's
thing
the
noted.
Reason that I can't sleep. 15. You
yeah,
say
but it's,
illegal.
You say
there
go
we ahead,
go.
Baco.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's the next line that really sells how different things were. You know, I mean, this makes Christine 16 look like an appropriate story. I mean, you say illegal. Well,
illegal.
I say illegal has never been my scene. Well, you're so fucking 15-year-olds. You can't jump it up a few years and still get off. I don't know.
And the thing is, it didn't hit me. When I was a kid, because I'm listening to it, I'm 13. She's only 15. What's the problem? You know what I mean? It's like Winger 17. She's only 17. That seems like a pretty old lady. It's all perspective.
I always misheard the lyric too. Like I thought it was "I drive like hell, but I'm out of control." Instead of "I try like hell." Maybe it was like a Freudian kind of thing where I wanted it to be bad.
Yeah.
You know,
R. Kelly's favorite song, though, by the way.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, in the 70s...
Did he actually go that old?
Maybe not.
Well, I did a whole episode called Statutory Rock with the guys from Shabby Road where we just talked about this.
Hey, do an episode two. I want to come on for that one.
Yeah. But,
oh,
you know,
God, yeah.
Ringo Starr had a number one hit in the 70s with She's 16, She's Beautiful, and She's Mine or whatever. It was like, it was just like acceptable at one point. It's just really odd, yeah. So.
Yeah, it's I really like the riff on this song. I like the song a lot. This is actually now, Girls Goes Girls, we can summarize at the end. But basically, if I'm a Keepers, it goes the first three tracks, side one, and this one, thus far.
I think the song on the surface is fine. It has the elements of what would be a good song of this style, but it's just so weak and generic to me that it just doesn't really stand up.
But again, the whole
thing about, I think this song is lifted by the quality of the two opening tracks. But as far as a song on this record, I really don't have that big of an issue with it.
Yeah.
No, but it did show like this. Motley did a great job of just objectifying women at this point. Like between the album title, imagery, and this one is just like, we'll get to the next one too.
I think that was their job. I think that was their whole job.
Yeah.
Yeah, the next one, Something for Nothing.
Ooh.
I don't really have much good to say about this one either.
This one, too, is one that at the first, you know, couple passes, I was like, wait, hold on. Oh, Vince Neil is just a gigolo. You know, he's just getting paid to go around and bang girls, girls, girls. I
no,
thought this song was...
No, he's not getting paid. He's just not paying.
What you talking
he's
about?
Something for Nothing. He's not getting, you know, nothing for something.
Incorrect. He is saying he's getting paid for doing something that is basically fun for him to do anyway. Leave the cash on the dresser.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, he plays music for free. The money that he gets is for banging chicks.
No, this song is about him being a gigolo and getting paid to have sex with these ladies. That's what Vince Neil is. That's the whole song. If this is not what the song is about, this is completely ruined.
Target practice in the dark.
That's not subtle.
He loves his work, man.
That's what I'm talking about. I remember that they said that they tried to add this to the set list and it just didn't work live, which I can see. But I do like the song. I do like the song, though. You know, like it? Nah?
No, I think it sucks.
Yeah,
I
don't like it.
They went on to have a hit with it on their next record with Same Old Situation.
Yeah, you say that. I don't see that, though. That's about some two lesbian chicks that start getting mad.
You know you can rewrite a song and change the topical theme of the lyrics, correct?
Yeah, and it but that one is completely different. Like the, it's like a poison
something
song.
Something for nothing, same old situation. Yeah, they're fucking just light years apart from each other.
Light years apart.
My God, it's three
big
words.
Time.
Lots of S's.
I don't see it. I'll have to see. What does he talk? Does Nicky talk about that in the Heroin Diaries? He says might rewrite the song for Dr. Feelgood.
The Heroin Diaries don't go that far in the timeline.
That's very precise. A lot of detail in those diaries. You maybe bookmark it for later.
I would need the next year of his life is what I'm getting at. This is.
I don't know. There's some time problems there. Please, BJ. We've derailed your show.
Well, what I've been thinking is. Nikki Sixx was obviously a very talented songwriter, but he was such a fuck-up that he just wouldn't put the time and effort in to write a whole album at this point, you know?
Or ever, actually.
So you just end up with these songs that when you listen to something, you're for nothing. You're thinking, Nikki, you could do better than this, man. You're better than this, you know.
Well, here's a counterpoint to that. I mean, could he? I've made this argument with a lot of different people. Ace Frehley being one of my favorite guys. I don't know. I mean, people always want the peak of somebody, and then remove the parts they don't like. So yeah, this album is not him at his best. I think this song is not him at his best, but I don't think you can necessarily remove everything, you know, and just because he is you're right, he's a total fuck up. And if he wasn't, and he could knuckle down, maybe he could do something better. But that all is part of the same package. I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking too big picture here, or too deep.
Well, it's just if you look at Too Fast for Love and Shout at the Devil, they're really strong as albums all the way through. And then as soon as they get successful and he goes off the rails, you know, he can't put an album together anymore. And a lot of it just seems like he pulled it out of his ass.
They're trying to cram a lot of music into a fairly short period of time. And on top of, you know, being a bit of a mess, he's got to be, you know, top his best work, you know, in a, you know, 2 month period. So, it seems like that would at least hinder it a little bit.
Yeah, it's true that when they're spending so much time on tour, it's not as much time to write the songs. And then they want to get the album done as fast as they can to get it out and then go back on tour. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like a vicious cycle.
This is, you know, written basically in the studio. And I guess if you have an unlimited amount of time, you know, maybe that's not a bad way to do it, but for the most part, it seems like, you know, the results of, you know, aren't really, you know, encouraging overall when you hear stories of records that are largely written in this studio.
No. Which, speaking of which, what I read is the next song was written in the studio, You're All I Need, which Nikki wrote for his ex-girlfriend, Nicole, who he believed had cheated on him with Jack Wagner from General Hospital.
I absolutely love this story, and I don't care if it's true or not. I just want it to be.
Well, about how he wanted to pay some bikers to break Wagner's kneecaps or whatever.
Well, not that part. The part where he ends up writing a song, the same title of that, of, you know, Jack Wagner probably is. That song is probably more famous than the name Jack Wagner.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
Maybe not at the time, but I know the song, and I just love the idea that, like, as payback to a bad relationship, he writes a song with the same title, but it's about a man killing his whatever wife, girlfriend, and then burying her in the backyard.
Yeah,
with the same, and it has a very kind of pretty chorus. And, boy, it's just dark though, and frankly, again, not something you saw a lot of during this time. I mean, this is a ballad. And it's about as dark as you can get.
Yeah, it's like, this is Home Sweet Home Part 2. You know? Yeah, it's crazy.
Home Sweet Home. Now I'm going to kill you, and then I'm going to bury you in the backyard of our home sweet home. And the video was banned, right? Like, something with it. I've actually watched it and found it fairly, I don't know, not that big a deal, I guess.
I don't remember it ever being on back then.
Well, it was never being played. I know that. Yeah, this was basically a two-video record. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there's a lot of good melodic moments in the song, but the song is always going to be about the lyrics in the end.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't get past that part that makes it
I think I can. I enjoy listening to it.
I always did like it, but there's this dichotomy of the tone of the song or the vibe of what kind of song it is, and then the lyrics.
Great though.
He's back. Did the manager come out and like, sir, if you're going to use our Wi-Fi much longer, you got to buy a mattress?
I did. This cost me $3,000.
I'm not buying a queen.
But I now have a perfectly calibrated Sleep Number mattress for home. So I'll be very well rested. So thanks, Baco and BJ. But yes, I was on mute there for a second. But yeah, this song is, you know, it's, I used to love her, but I had to kill her without the sense of humor, without the snark or whatnot. It is a great. I love this song, and I love
there's a little tongue in cheek to it.
You think?
I always took it that way, yeah.
I take it as in that the only tongue-in-cheek in it is that Nikki is kind of putting it past the label to push this as a single, because this was on the radio by me, at least. I don't know if it was actually officially a single, or was it not? Do you have that?
Yeah, it was a single in the video, but I never saw it at all.
Like you guys talked about. Well, it was in decent rotation here, and I just liked it because you would have, you know, girls at times like, oh, this is a Motley Crue song I actually like. I'm like, you have no idea what's going on in the song in the background. And it was like one of the, like Baco has talked about in other episodes of other things. I love the juxtaposition of the lyrics with the happy ballad kind of sneaking this past Home Sweet Home kind of deal. I think this is the third best song on the album.
Well, there's a story that Doc McGee played it for John Bon Jovi, and he said they'd written the greatest song of their career, and I don't think he caught the lyrics. I think John missed it, you know.
Well, I'm pretty sure he didn't, because he was just concentrated on looking himself in the mirror and making
but
sure
yeah,
he's looking nice.
I wrote
John
down
also played "The Time of Your Life" at his daughter's wedding from Green Day.
Oh, that's good. That's a good. I never noticed that until you told me that either, Baco, because I just didn't really care about the lyrical content
I love songs like that, though. They just kind of pull past the general public, you know, and it's like you have to be someone like a BJ Cramp who's going to release a podcast, Rock and Roll, named after a comment on The Simpsons, I assume, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of deep kind of thing where you actually pay attention. I love the fact that sometimes this shit gets out there. You know, I'll admit, I didn't know until maybe 5-10 years ago what that whole how dark that Pina Colada song was.
Yeah, basically you're cheating on somebody, I'm cheating on you, and whoops, we found each other at the bar together. That's basically that. That's a meat cheat cute.
And it was Nikki and his girlfriend Nicole, and he took her home, killed her, and buried her.
That's right. Song. Yeah, but this is basically like a born in the USA, you know? If you're not paying attention, you don't know what it's about.
Yeah, it's not a pro America anthem, but
right,
America.
But
America.
Is it supposed
great
to
American.
Be funny?
Nikki Sixx, great American. Great American.
I think part of the reason it doesn't come off that way is Vince. I don't think he can sell the snark. I always listen to it lyrically with the idea that it was Nikki, and Nikki always has kind of had that a little bit of ability to, you know, maybe not. Not the high end of this stuff, you know, like some of the other songwriters we could talk about, like John Lennon or something. But he had a way to kind of like wink, you know, lyrically at you and say, you know, I mean, this is clearly metaphorical. I'm having a little fun. This is kind of a really enjoyable way to pay back an ex who I think is a bitch.
Yeah, I always thought it was kind of supposed to be a joke. It's weird to have a song on your album that's like a ballad. Well, you just had a big hit ballad, and then you have a ballad, but it's really kind of a joke, but it's also presented as a good song, but you have to like really listen to catch on to what he's actually saying. There's a lot going on with it.
Yeah. And does Tommy play piano on this one too? I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't think Tommy's ever played piano.
With his dick.
With his dick. That's why he's so good. He's got one extra finger.
By the way, if you were asking about what that sound was in the Wild Side, that was his dick hitting a hole. It wasn't what Baco was talking about. It's kind of like whatever that was beside the drum. It's his dick hitting a pole. But yeah, I mean, when you hear Vince saying, it might have been supposed to have some snark, but the whole... the blade of my knife faced away from your heart those last few nights sliced you apart. That doesn't sound funny, really. You know, especially when Vince does it. So,
but then he also says, but hey, we finally made the news. Come on. I mean, that is...
That part... No, I get that part. That part's
right
genius.
After that. Yes, you lead up, and then you hit that like, hey, but look at the bright side. You know what I mean? Yes.
From sure, from our writing...
you died in a horrific, you died a horrific death where I sliced you, you know, to bits and you bled out. But hey, look, we made the front page.
But that was going to the whole like serial killer wanting the fame and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Like people want the attention.
Well, in Looks That Kill, Vince is the one who gets sliced apart, right? She'll slice you apart, right?
Yeah. What a slicing.
So now
back,
it's
bitch.
A reversal.
Yeah. Thought it was all cool.
How'd you like to have Vince Neil on one of those infomercials? With some kind of nice.
Look, hold on. I'm sorry. I'm picking out some of these lyrics, but like now it's lonely as hell from this padded cell. You know, yeah. They paint a picture where it doesn't actually, you know, turn out good for the protagonist in this situation, or at least the main character.
Yeah, but he finally made the news.
Exactly. There is a lot of little subtle tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, you're right. I'm just saying that like going back to it, that Vince doesn't sell it as well as it comes off. It's a very clever song. I like it.
Tom Orman did the best he could with him. It took 18 hours, but he pieced together, you know, the 3 minutes of Vince.
Well, yeah, and echoing the Jack Wagner song title is hilarious. And also, that song only had come out in 1985, so it wasn't a very old song at all.
Correct.
Guys, I'm not sure if I can wait any longer. Can we get to my favorite song on the album next?
Can I tell you what I wrote down from my notes? I got like basically the track listing.
Sure.
For number 10, I wrote down filler. I have no additional notes.
Well, yeah, that's
well,
exactly
at least they're consistent.
But
they're consistent on both sides. For
yeah.
Yeah.
If you want, BJ, I'll text you a picture of that.
I wrote down unbelievable. It really couldn't be worse.
Yeah.
Is this even live?
Who knows?
Even live.
Who cares?
Yeah, I mean, talk about all the songs in the world you could throw. Because how many covers? Let's see, they did Helter Skelter,
Smoking in the Boys' Room. You know, they
Smoking
had
in the Boys' Room. Yeah, so they almost have a cover.
They did Anarchy in the UK. That was a disaster.
Yeah, that was terrible. Okay, but up to this point, it was kind of a thing.
Yeah,
less their first album to throw a cover of some sort on there.
Right.
But talk about just what. Does anybody need this?
No.
Does anybody need Vince doing Elvis in one of the most obvious Elvis? I don't know. I mean, maybe he was singing this because he just got out of jail.
Oh, jeez. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, they were playing this live. And maybe that was like they were.
Were they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay, I didn't see the tour.
They might have done that as like a way to throw Mick Mars a bone. So they would play one song from his teen years.
Oh, my youth.
Thank you.
Say this, we are on the precipice of like what was going on musically, where like almost it seemed like we need 12 tracks to a record. So a band like Motley Crue releasing a 9 or 8 song record would have been
eight.
I'm saying if you dial this back,
yeah,
just the lack of tracks, this is not like a prog rock band, would have stuck out. I mean, I remember people. I mean, Def Leppard released Hysteria, you know, this year, that had 12 tracks. That was a big deal. Mechanical Resonance by Tesla.
Right.
And that all kind of built up and peaked, I think, in the late 80s, you know, where Kiss decided they had to have 15 fucking songs out in the shade. But so I think it would have been problematic for them to basically say, like, look, we got to do something. We need 2 more tracks. And it was fucking Nona and Jailhouse Rock.
Right. Yeah. What is the total length of this? Is this album like 37 minutes with those on there, or 35? It can't be that long on Wiki. I'm just curious.
All the songs are, a lot of the songs are over 4 minutes, so they managed to pad it out that way. True. Yeah, I wrote down that this is basically an EP with padding. You know,
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is before, like, you know, Metallica and Danzig had some hits with EPs, so nobody was talking about that.
So on this, do anything else you want to say about Jailhouse Rock? Because I have some notes down here, too.
Go for it.
Okay. Just basically...
Oh, I'm sorry. Not my show.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was asking BJ, Paco.
Yeah, I answered for him, and then I was like, that was rude. how rude.
No, but I mean, they named it Girls, Girls, Girls after the 3 good songs on the album. Essentially, is what it is. Is that it is maybe a 3 or 4 track album for me, maybe 5. You got the first 3 tracks, side 1, and then Something for Nothing, and
I got 6
a little bit. You got 6? I got 5. Yeah, I got 5.
I
got 5.
6. I think I'm glad I have in my life. The rest I can deal without. I can give you the running time real quick. It where'd it go? 39 minutes and 47 seconds.
Wow, that's more than I thought. Okay.
Yeah, all I ever listened to is the first 3 songs, but that's good enough for me. You know, I'm happy to have just 3 songs that I like, and they're right in a row, so it's fine. All the royalties for this version of Jailhouse Rock probably went to Colonel Tom Parker. that's all I could think about. And it's that fucker. But
can you imagine that guy at home getting a royalty check? He's like, Motley Crue.
I always think about that, though. You know, a band like this puts a cover on a record and somebody's getting some nice checks. They're like, holy shit.
This sold, what did this sell? 3 million?
Probably something like that.
2? At least double.
Yeah, definitely double.
This is how my story unfolds.
Well, thanks a lot, guys, for doing this with me, Baco and Loose Cannon.
Thanks for having us, man.
What did Michael Butler, zoo jockeys or whatever he was saying?
Yeah.
We're having fun at his expense, but yeah, check out the Rock and Roll Geek Show.
Yeah, people should check you guys out at Cobras and Fire. You have a lot of. You did that great Black Sabbath series recently. Oh, I love the Dave Walker interview and just like going, you know, deep like that. That's the name, right? The guy that was
you got that
right before Never Say Die. Yeah,
I did not know that name until basically Baco interviewed him. I did. Did you know that story all along?
He was. Yeah, there's that clip on YouTube where they played it. They played Junior's Eyes on some TV show.
Well, yeah. It's weird. How many views does that have? I'm just saying. Like, I consider myself a pretty solid Sabbath fan, but for some reason, that part of their history. I mean, I have the whole box set. I've read books. That's my point. That's pretty cool when you find.
I bet I read about it from some Martin Popoff book. You know, I have a bunch of Martin Popoff books.
That's right. And I interviewed Martin Popoff for that whole
thing. Oh, yeah, that's right. He's been on my show a couple times, but he's kind of a difficult. I had a difficult time with him.
I don't know that I connected with him. I had fun with him, though.
Yeah, it's the same feeling, right? You didn't connect with him?
I remember I gave him a heads up when I posted it. I was like, just so you know, we're a little goofy. And he's like, oh, boy, you guys are like rocking. He almost like Michael Butler said, but a little more nice.
Right.
Anyway. Well, thank you for that. Yeah, you can find us everywhere. Just type Cobras and Fire podcast in your internet search item.
You got some ambient noise.
that had to be coming from Loose Cannon. I think he was doing a bong hit there. He is in Colorado. Oh, he must have muted out anyway.
I unmuted because I am driving through the snow right now, trying to make a left turn in a blizzard.
Yeah, we're probably going to get you fired.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The blizzard's heading this way, too.
Exactly. Oh, you know, fuck. What I was hoping was to be fired talking about the Motley Crue album from 1987.
Life goals with Loose Cannon.
Just doing my job while losing my job.
Hey, there's a new slogan.
All right. Thanks, BJ.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
All right.
Is that good?
Yeah, we're good.
for you to present a brand new award here at the MTV Music Awards. This is Motley Crue.
This award is for the best heavy metal video.
And by the way, Jethro Tull is not nominated. Okay, and the winner is? All right, Guns N' Roses!
Back.